You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Friday, 26 June. I'm Simon Brown, coming to you live and loud from MoneyWeb Studios in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, we chat with Mia Kruger. We want to touch on some of that unemployment, some Berkshire Hathaway. We've also got Justin Schmidt from ABSA. Normally resilient food and beverage producers are really struggling under lockdown. And then we've got Roland Peens from Wine Cellar. What about investing in wine instead of the usual drinking the wine? So morning headlines, business day. Moody's skeptical of South Africa's debt consolidation plans, and from CNBC, Nike reports unexpected loss as sales tumble 38%. Morning markets overnight, the US green S&P 500 and the NASDAQ up 1.1%. Asia following green, we've got Sydney up 0.8 and Tokyo up 1% respectively. Commodities, it's green everywhere. Commodities all green as well. Oil leading the way, gold up just a little. The rand 30 cents stronger from this time yesterday, trading at 17.14, and the top 40 opening call for about a 0.8% green opening.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
We got Mia Kruger. She's a director at Kruger International. Mia, I want to quickly touch on the US initial claims that we've been seeing coming through. Another plus 1 million yesterday, so another week of what would have been an absolute record smashing number just as recently as March, I suppose. It is continuing, but it does seem to have kind of well off those April levels and I mean, scary numbers, but you know, in this sort of pandemic environment, scary numbers have almost become blasé.
Yes, you're right, Simon. Hi, good morning. I think if we just, keep our heads on focused on the reality, and that's the fact that there's still, you know, it has come down, but there's still more than 20 million rather people without work than before we saw the COVID-19 pandemic breakout. So that's the real challenge here. We'll have to see those people start getting back into the workforce, being absorbed back into the workforce. And there are so many opinions out there. I just listened to a couple of fund managers this week that I talk to regularly, and they were of polar opposite positions. One of the fund managers in 91, I listened to Philip Sanders, and he was of the view that they were definitely going to see a V-shaped recovery with all these workers being taken up in the economies straight away again, where some of the others, Franklin Templeton to be specific, were of the view that this is going to be a W or a longer U-shaped recovery, and it's going to take maybe years for this to recover. So there are still so many views out there. Yesterday we saw the market in the US open lower, and I was actually thinking, okay, reality starting to set in again, but it just lasted for a bit, and I mean, it turned around again, and we're seeing the markets in Asia this morning up again as well. So there's no sanity prevailing at this stage, and there's still so many opinions out there.
And at this point, I mean, as I was saying in my intro, everything is green. Don't fight the market. I think you've been to the Berkshire Hathaway AGM. I'm pretty sure you went to in Omaha. I'm seeing people out there, and there's some Twitter people, and I'm not talking them. I'm talking proper fund managers and the like, complaining that maybe Berkshire Hathaway simply become overly diverse, overly large, and sort of going to struggle going forward to deliver market-beating returns, in a sense, almost becoming a victim of its success. Where would you sit on the Berkshire maybe being over the hill, or is it still something worth considering?
I'd be a little slow to criticize. We've seen Berkshire underperform the markets in times for shorter terms, but we know their long-term track record is very, very stable. We know, you know, that Warren Buffett isn't alone in his very cautious stance at this stage. Yesterday, I listened to an interview with Mohammed Al-Erian, and he's exactly in the same position. Mm-hmm. And then there are many other large fund managers that are also very cautiously positioned at this stage. Despite, you know, the cautious positioning, your other question was the fact that they are so large these days. and that they have to do meaningful deals to really add to that portfolio. You know what? The big thing is when we also look at the diversification of a company like that, I think it's a good thing to be very widely diversified. When you consider ETFs or any passives where index tracking is used, you know, people are actually getting a much better ride if they have a wider and more diversified portfolio than when they have big and large sort of very convinced positions. So, yes, I think it's important to note that.
Yeah, we've lost Maya there, disappeared off my screens. She made two great points there. The one is never underestimate long-term investing. That really is the story, and that really is Warren Buffett's story. And the diversification, it's critically important that we do diversify. And we can argue sometimes that diversification is simply too wide, but I don't know. I'm a fan of it. There's huge risk to concentration risk. But we're not getting Mia back. We'll leave her there for now. Mia Kruger, Director to Kruger International. Always appreciate the time.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
I got Justin Schmidt on the line. He's head new sector development and relationship banking at Absa Retail and Business Bank. Justin, morning. Appreciate your time. The Absa manufacturing survey conducted by Bureau for Economic Research out yesterday. This was for second quarter of 2020. Shows a fall from 17 to down to 6 in the second quarter. It was tough before the pandemic. It's now got a whole lot tougher. In essence, the data is confirming what we expected to see on the ground, that lockdown, especially the hard level 5 lockdown, really, really hurt our economy.
Morning, Simon. Yeah, so that's exactly the point. We knew that the manufacturing sector was under pressure before this, but as you said, the data has just confirmed everything. And what's worrying and interesting is that when we look at subsectors within manufacturing, we're seeing the severity of the lockdown, so areas like textiles, transport, furniture hitting zero in their confidence, meaning 100% of the survey respondents were saying, you know, they're more pessimistic about the future than they are optimistic. So, you know, the numbers are confirming, but they're also worrying, and the trend continues downwards.
And it ties in. I was just chatting with Mia Kruger, and she was talking about, you know, the debates out there about a V-shaped or a W-shaped or a U or an L. And you know, we're talking from a theoretical perspective, and truthfully, we're talking from share prices and market movements. But when we chat to people on the ground, and this is obviously that's the real economy as opposed to the market, the people on the ground, the manufacturers, they are deeply pessimistic. They I mean, you talk around a, you know, zero level for looking forward. That really tells us the story of what is happening in the economy as opposed to what's happening in the stock market.
Yeah, and I think it's to be expected when you're operating under even 50% production or the lockdown levels allows you to produce 50% of your stock rate, you are going to see that. I think what's also worrying is that if you talk markets and what markets look at is the production inefficiencies that we see. So, you know, even essential services that we're allowed to operate at 100%, you think pessimism in there. And part of that pessimism is the production inefficiency and the demand for them. So even though they're operating, the fact that the tourism sector, for example, or your restaurants were not operating at full capacity, it was having knock-on effects. So I think that's the other point, that there's knock-on effects to the lockdown. And even your essential service industries are feeling that. The other point with that is that, you know, when you're not operating at 100% capacity, there's other constraints on the sector. Your margins are squeezed because your unit costs go up. So yeah, we're seeing multiple effects, and I think what manufacturers want to see is demand increase again. So through various demand-driven responses, and then also just the opening up and the sector being less efficient because they can operate at 100%.
Yeah, I take that point. I mean, the inefficiencies, partly that, you know, response to the pandemic and in terms of keeping, you know, staff and supply chains safe. It's also just the supply chains. And as you say, What then happens is not only is demand down, but your unit cost is then increasing. That creates a challenge. The other challenge they're particularly seeing, and I note this morning Eskom CEO saying that they expect only 3 days of level one load shedding during winter, but power supply, truthfully, remains a challenge. And it just throws another stick in what is an already massively tough space.
Yeah, so there we're getting to kind of the constraints that we were feeling before the lockdown, before COVID. And you know, interestingly, if you look at manufacturing sales over the last decade, they've gone up. But if you start looking at volumes in the industry, it only just recovered to global financial crisis levels. And part of that constraint was the energy issue. We know that load shedding and the availability of energy has been an issue for a long time. And it seems to be that there is still that restriction, with Eskom only achieving or not even achieving the 80% that availability of energy that's set out in the integrated resource plan. So this is a major constraint to manufacturers, on top of other constraints that they were seeing pre-lockdown, things like political constraints. So that lumps everything in, anything that they see as political, including Eskom. The cost of energy is also a constraint for the sector, and demand's been a massive constraint. So things like infrastructure spend, subsectors like steel have seen massive constraints, because if you're not building those roads and there's no rebar going into buildings and that sort of thing, it is a big constraint in their output.
The one that, food and beverage producers typically fairly resilient, but obviously, at this point, with the industries they supply into shut down for April and slowly sort of starting to open up, even the more resilient spaces are really, really struggling. A slight uptick in the food and beverage producers, but still struggling and still indicating, you mentioned a moment ago, just how wide and deep this pandemic is hurting manufacturing. We're talking South Africa, but this is a global phenomenon, and frankly, something which is going to leave long-lasting scars in our economy.
Yeah, and that's one that we watch closely, because, like you say, the resilience of the food and beverage sector. If I go back to what I said now of the output volumes for manufacturing over the last 10 years, when we look at food and beverage, for example, we didn't even see the effects of the global financial crisis. That subsector just keeps on going. I think we've got a world-class agriculture sector. We have great food and beverage manufacturing, but still the 17 number, even though it is an improvement, it means 83% of respondents are more pessimistic about the future. So it just is even resilient subsectors are feeling the pinch.
Yeah, and I go back to the point that the debate around the shape of the recovery is a debate around the stock market. What's happening on the ground is tough, is real tough. Justin Smith, he is head new sector development and relationship banking at Absa Retail and Business Bank. Justin, appreciate your time.
Business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now
with Simon Brown
on The Money. Also available on podcast.
Now, I've been waiting all week for this interview, investing in wine with Roland Pienz of Wine Cellar. I'm a complete novice of wine. I know I like red wine. Truthfully, I like red wine a lot. Maybe some would say too much. Roland, investing in wine, I suppose it's one of those things. Some people would look at the stock market and scratch their heads, and because I'm deeply involved in a daily basis, I think it's easy. I look at wine and I scratch my head and I think, I know red and white and that's about my limit. This is something where, as an investor into wine, most of us are going to actually need guidance from pros, understanding what matters and what really works.
Morning, Simon. Yeah, thanks for having me on. That's the magic about wine. It's quite a mysterious product. It's produced all around the world, but yet some wines cost a lot more than others. And as technology has advanced, as the Internet of Things comes on board, prices of wines are tracked and monitored more and more. And there's a stock exchange of wine in London. There's a very big fine wine market, about $6 to $8 billion worth. And certainly it's a formal alternative asset industry which one can invest in.
Is it around scarcity? Is it around quality? Is it around geography? Or is it a blend of all of the above in terms of determining investability in a bottle of wine?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a number of factors. Scarcity and rarity certainly plays a large role. And you can imagine once the wine is released, over time it gets consumed and less and less supply there is in the market. Brand equity is key. There are certain wines which hold brand equity, for instance, Dom Perignon over others, and their volume doesn't play as much of a role. And then the quality is very important. And wine critics around the world will assess wines and they'll give them a score. And those scores are very keenly linked to the price appreciation or the price movement of certain stocks.
The tricky part, perhaps, is that wine is not a forever investment. At some point, you need to drink it, or perhaps you need to sell it. You know, wine ages, but I opened a bottle during lockdown that I should have drunk a decade ago. It was almost 30 years old, and I'd overdone it in that sense. You actually suggest, perhaps, as a strategy, is kind of invest in wine, and then at a maturity point, drink half, sell half, and then use the half you sell to go and reinvest. But in essence, what you're saying is, you know, this needs to be almost an active investment. You can't leave this for generations at a time.
No, certainly. It needs to be active, and one needs to look at your portfolio and see which ones are offering the best returns and the time to exit certain stocks. And really depends on which wines you're keeping. Fine Bordeaux, for instance, really does need 20 to 25 years to reach its maturity.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And can last for a very, very long time. I've had Bordeaux wines at 100, 150 years old, which are still remarkable. South African wines, from the data that we've seen trading on Strauss & Co.'s fine wine auction and on WineSellers platform, we see that the return is possibly the best within 10 years. Although that said, I've done some analysis on a Mellis Rubicon 1982, and that's seen compound annual growth of around 16 to 18% and since it was released, and that was, 35 years ago. So it certainly is a long-term investment, but there is a lot of an analysis that needs to come into play.
What sort of, if someone thinking, cool, let's get into this wine investing, two questions. How much do we need to sort of dip our toe in the water? And you know, I suppose we really want to, as my market commentator was saying a moment ago, you kind of want a diverse sort of managed collection almost in a sense. But how much do we need to get started in this?
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't certainly put a lot of retirement immunity into it. But if you look during the COVID time, wine certainly hasn't fallen off a cliff like some of the other industries have. In fact, the largest fine wine index lost 6% over the last few months. So certainly having a portion of it as an investment would have helped the portfolio. But starting off in South Africa, you could buy just one case of wine, and that could cost you 5,000-6,000 rand. And as long as it's stored correctly, ideally in a professional setting, a temperature-controlled environment, you know, that would be enough for you to start an investment, and then a few years later you could either sell it on auction or sell it through a merchant. So one doesn't have to have a huge amount of money. In fact, the fine wine market in South Africa is really small compared to the rest of the world, and there's lots of room for growth.
Yeah, I was chatting wine with my wife last night. If I spent 5,000 in a case, that would be exactly past her point of threshold of pain. But I take your point. I don't need hundreds of thousands, even millions. I can literally just get a case. I need to store it somewhere. That's important. A last question. I've got a wine expert on the line. So this weekend, if you're having a sort of a non-fancy bottle of wine with your dinner one evening, what would be one of your fave everyday drinks for us sort of non-wine experts?
Sure, well, that's an interesting point. South Africa makes the cheapest wines in the world at the bottom end and at the top end of the market. So the South African consumer is very lucky, and doesn't seem like it, but we get great bottles of wine even at the 60, 80, 100 rand price point. So if I were to say something like a wood trap or white or red, that's a remarkable value for money. And then in the hundreds of rands, there are lots of boutique producers producing at the 100 rand level, Cezanne, Syrah, Carina, Syrah, those are at the 100, 150 level. There's lots to choose from, and it really is a buyer's market at the moment.
And I suddenly feel so smart because I had some wolf trap this very week. So I do know maybe something. It was red. I liked it. And now I've got an expert enjoying it. Investing in wine, that's Roland Pienz of Wine Cellar. Roland, really appreciate your time this morning. That's it for today. You'll find us live every morning, 6:30 a.m. every weekday morning on moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app. Podcast available from 7 a.m. Chat to us on the social medias, Twitter, Facebook. Use the hashtag MoneyWebNow. My thanks to you for listening, to my guests for availing themselves on an early morning, my producer Cordora and sound engineer Eddie. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again Monday.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.